there, welcome to Blockhead, the podcast where cartoonists talk comics and just about everything else. My name is Jeff Grogan. I'm a cartoonist, animator, and illustrator, and for the next hour or so, I'll be your host in a series of conversations with comics creators about their lives, their work, and comics. So sit back and enjoy. Hey there, welcome to a brand new episode of Blockhead. Today's guest should need no introduction. Today we have the great Bill Griffith with us. Bill Griffith of Zippy the Pinhead, one of the founding members of the underground comics movement, is here, and I couldn't be more excited. My gosh, his career spans really the last 50 years or so. It's amazing to think about how long he's been involved in comics and how important his participation and his contribution have been to the world of comics we inhabit today. My gosh, it just wouldn't be the same without Bill Griffith. I mean, think about it, right? Going back all the way to 1968 and Young Lust and Mr. Toad and then Zippy the Pinhead and Arcade with Art Spiegelman and so much that's come from the great pen of Bill Griffith that has been so important in the history of comics, really. He's one of those towering figures of comics that I've always admired, and I'm so thrilled to have him here today. And the ostensible reason for Bill's appearance here today is the Nancy Fest, which is coming up right around the corner, May 24th and 25th at the Billy Ireland Cartoon Library and Museum on the Ohio State campus in Columbus, Ohio. A great festival of all things Nancy, a wonderful two-day event. And Bill is participating on Saturday, I believe, and he will be doing a talk about his great book, his wonderful brand new book, Three Rocks, The Story of Ernie Bushmiller. And it is, believe me, I've read it. It's a terrific book, great biography. Everything you ever wanted to know about Ernie Bushmiller. But I have to say, before I read it, I was, and I bet you are too, wondering, geez, how do you make a compelling story about a guy who sits at a drawing board all day, 12 hours a day, 7 days a week? There's not a lot that's going on there, but it is an incredibly captivating book and a great story. There's a lot of original Ernie Bushmiller Nancy stuff included in the book, as well as, of course, Bill's own great, great work. And Bill takes several surprising turns in his approach to Ernie Bushmiller's story. And like all of his graphic biographies of the past 10 years or 9 years or whatever it is, it's got a great sense of place and time. The era comes alive. So does, the place, the Bronx, whether it's the Bronx or it's the bullpen of the New York World, or Connecticut, where Ernie Bushmiller lived with his wife later. You can feel the environment and the era, and it's a wonderful story. So I highly recommend it. And if you're going to Nancy Fest or you're going to the Nancy Show, you absolutely have to read this book beforehand. So definitely look for it. Pick it up. Three Rocks, The Story of Ernie Bushmiller by Bill Griffith. Don't miss it. And it comes on the heels of course, Bill's other graphic biographies. The first was Invisible Ink, the story of his mother's affair with a famous cartoonist. It's really a memoir about Bill's life, and it's a very moving book. It really allows, through circumstances, through his mother's estate and whatnot, Bill had access really to the inner life of his mother, in a way, and her romance with this cartoonist who was a tangential figure in Bill's life. And, I think we've all wondered what our parents are thinking or feeling at any given time. And we never really have access to our parents as people, And it's so it's a rare privilege, really, that Bill has in having that material and being able to know what his mother was going through, what she was feeling at a particular time. And that's both, as the book makes clear, that's both a gift, but it's also a double-edged sword because, there are things you really don't want to know about your parents. And sometimes it's hard to think of them as people, even as we grow older. I often find myself wondering what my parents thought at any given stage of their lives, but I don't have access. And so anyway, it makes for a wonderful book, wonderful story. And then, of course, there's Nobody's Fool, which is the story of Schlitzie the Pinhead, who was in many ways the inspiration for Zippy the Pinhead, Bill's venerable comic strip that has been syndicated by King Features since the mid-1980s and was in alternative weeklies before that. Zippy, of course, is that surreal comic, that satirical comic that really looks at contemporary life from a very skewed lens. It's a wonderful comic strip, particularly if you're one of those people who is looking for a viewpoint that is not the run-of-the-mill, not the cliche, but also there's a certain poetry to Zippy that I find. And I find that when I read that comic strip, I have to put aside any kind of preconceptions about what a comic strip should be or what a gag comic strip should be, because Zippy doesn't fit into any of those. Zippy is more like a work of poetry, really. Absurdist poetry, of course, but nevertheless, it should be read that way, I think. And it's very rewarding if you take the time to read it from that perspective, I think. So, and then, of course, after Nobody's Fool, there is Three Rocks, which is why Bill is here today. And we talk about that, and we talk about the genesis of that book and his participation in Nancy Fest and what attracted him to Nancy and Ernie Bushmiller's work in the first place. So this is a wonderful conversation. It's really been a dream for me, and I hope you enjoy it as much as I enjoyed talking with Bill. So without further ado then, the great Bill Griffith and myself in conversation. Hello, Bill Griffith, and welcome to Blockhead. It's great to have you here.
Glad to be here.
Yeah. Ostensibly, we're here to talk about, obviously, before I even get that far, I should just say you need no introduction to people who are listening to this podcast. I mean, your career is just extraordinary, and it covers pretty much the history of comics for the last 50 years. I mean, it's incredible. There's like more than we can cover in this podcast to talk about. But ostensibly, we're here because of the Nancy Fest and your participation in Nancy Fest on May 24th and 25th. And from what I understand, you're doing a presentation about your latest graphic novel, Three Rocks, the story of Ernie Bushmiller.
Yeah, well, it couldn't be at a more appropriate venue. The people at the Billy Ireland Museum in Columbus have a great place. They have this, they're on the campus of the University of Ohio, but they have their own building. I think comics have never gotten as much respect anywhere.
It's a beautiful building.
It is, yeah, and they have a museum, state-of-the-art, just wonderful. So, and they've been big supporters of Bushmiller and Nancy over the years. The one of the directors of the place actually has a beautiful Nancy costume.
Ah, okay.
Which she says she will wear during the festivities. So I'm looking forward to that. I've seen pictures, and it really is a nice costume.
Oh my God.
So yeah, I'm going to be talking about my graphic biography, mm-hmm. Ernie Bushmiller. He has his fans, he has his detractors. I hope my book will move some detractors into the fan group. Mm-hmm. A lot of people think of Bushmiller, they think of the strip as a kind of, quote, a dumb strip, a simple strip, a kid strip, pejorative words like that.
Mm-hmm.
But Bushmiller himself was anything but dumb. And my book pretty much lays out the case for how sophisticated he was and how sophisticated the strip is, that there's a lot more there than meets the eye. I say Charles Schulz did Peanuts and was basically the first in the Daily Comics world to honestly evoke childhood. So Peanuts is about what it's like to be a kid, specifically Charlie Brown. On the other hand, Nancy, the strip, is not what it's like to be a child. Nancy is what it's like to be a comic strip. So when you read Nancy, you are in essence, you are deep into the language of comics, whether you realize it or not. And it's a very sophisticated approach to that language. A lot of cartoonists would be very happy just to have a kind of, you know, characters that are relatable, that are sympathetic, that, you know, make the cartoonist a living. Ernie was really more into the mechanics of what a strip is and how he played with it, to a degree where in some ways it became actually surreal, but always with one object in mind, which he called the snapper, which was the punchline. And Bushmiller's punchlines are almost all sight gags. Perfect for the medium of comics. What you see in the last panel that makes you laugh is something that could only happen in the strip as it was developing to that point. He wasn't trying to make comments about society or relationships or anything. He was just trying to make a joke that could only be made in a comic strip. That's why I say it's really about what comics are. Mad Magazine cartoonist Wally Wood said, once you begin just looking at a Nancy strip, you're already reading it right in. It's impossible. It's done so iconically and clearly and simply that by the time you think, you know, gee, I wonder if I should read this strip, you've already read it.
It's more difficult not to read Nancy than it is to read Nancy.
That's what Wally Wood famously said, yes. Yeah. I don't think he was a big fan of Nancy.
Well, in the admission, though, there is some kind of admiration, I think, for it.
Oh, absolutely. No, he wrote a few things about Bushmiller, and they're all very admiringly, but, you know, he did great Nancy satire for Mad. So,
sure.
He had that kind of voice too.
I was just wondering, is Nancy revered among? Now, I'm, you know, just to say, I am a cartoonist, but I wanted to ask you if among your peers and others that you've come in contact with over the years, is Nancy sort of universally revered among cartoonists for the reasons that you're talking about?
Not universally. You know, Peanuts is universally revered. Crazy Cat is universally revered. Little Nemo is, there are these icons, these golden icons that everybody agrees are great in comics. Nancy kind of divides people between those who like and get it and those who just think it's a dumb strip. There are, fortunately for Nancy and Bushmiller, there are two ways to appreciate Nancy. One is on the simple level of its humor. And that accounts for a big chunk of the people who like Nancy among my peers. A lot of them just think, they kind of think of it as maybe a little kitschy, even a little bit of like almost folk art, somewhat naive. And part of its humor to them is what they think of as its naivete. I think that's a misreading of what you're looking at, but I'm happy, you know, to include those people in the group of Nancy fans, but I don't look at it that way. Dennis Kitchen famously talks about Nancy as being something that dares to be dumb. So he has his own way of looking at the strip, which I respect. It's not mine. We both think Nancy is great for different reasons. He likes it, and people that fall into that camp like Nancy, I think, because it's comics at its most basic level.
Yeah.
And done beautifully. So they respect it and they kind of like it. They don't fully appreciate, I think, what really is happening in the strip, but that's okay. Not everybody has to be in agreement with me. You know, Bushmiller himself, once you get into his life, like when I first saw Nancy, I was 5 years old, okay? Mm-hmm. I learned to read by reading the Sunday Funnies in Brooklyn when I was a kid. And what I learned from Nancy wasn't really so much how to read, but how to look at words, because Bushmiller's lettering was large mm-hmm. and it had very little punctuation.
Right.
So as a 4 or 5 year old learning to read, I wasn't confused by where a comma or a period went. There were no commas and periods. It was just real basic, easy to look at words. And I latched onto it. And in as well as with other comics, I learned how to read that way. Bushmiller, you know, when I first encountered him later, as an adult, I kind of left, you know, I let it go for decades. I didn't think about Nancy. Then in the early 70s, living in San Francisco, part of the underground comics scene there,
mm-hmm.
and a good friend of mine, Art Spiegelman, whenever I visited his apartment, he was my kind of tutor in comics history. He had the knowledge of comics history that I really didn't have.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things he would talk about with me was Nancy. And so I kind of made the full circle back from childhood to 1970, when I was like 26 years old. And I started to look at Nancy again with adult eyes and through Art Spiegelman's eyes a little bit.
Right.
And I began to really see that there was so much more there than I thought. Although at that time, this is so pre-internet, there was almost nothing available in terms of biography.
Right.
There was one paperback called Comics and Their Creators that came out, I think, in the late 40s that Art had a copy of. And it gave bios of all the major daily strip cartoonists of that time, including one of Ernie. But it was very sketchy. So I just thought Ernie Bushmiller was kind of a folk artist. You know, he was doing this great, sort of unconsciously surreal masterpiece. That's not true at all. once you dive into who he really was, which now, of course, we can do, and luckily for me, I had access to his neighbor, his assistant, his right-hand man, his good friend, who lived just a short distance from him in Connecticut. And he gave me all kinds of, you know, personal detail, including things like, you know, what did Ernie read? Mm-hmm. What other comics did he like? What kind of art did he like? I mean, the fact that he liked art at all was somewhat of a shock to me as I uncovered who Ernie was. His favorite artist was Velázquez.
Mm-hmm.
Go figure. You know, the court painter of 16th century Spain.
Yeah.
The fact that he even knew Velázquez, knew who he was, told you a lot. Ernie, it's one of the most astounding facts I came across. I've always been a huge fan of the painter Reginald Marsh,
mm-hmm.
whose subject matter was New York City, mostly in the 20s and 30s and 40s. I've always loved his work. One of the things I found out in my research, Reginald Marsh and Ernie were friends. They went to theaters together, specifically to the vaudeville and burlesque, to draw the strippers.
Oh, yes. That's in the book. Yes.
It's in the book. I mean, my head blew up when I saw this. My favorite artist and now my favorite cartoonist sitting in a seat in the 14th Street, you know, Gaiety Theater, mm-hmm. while strippers are disrobing and they're sketching.
One way to learn.
Their friendship didn't last very long. And it ended with a kind of an enigmatic statement where Ernie said he no longer wanted to see that sniveling little bastard again. So I searched and searched. I could not find out what was behind that. The friendship didn't last very long. They both met at a art school on the Upper West Side of New York, not a college type school, just a place where you went to draw from the model.
Mm-hmm.
They met there and they just got along. That tells you a lot right there. Ernie did that because he thought he really needed to improve his drawing of adults. He thought, I can draw kids okay, but I really have to improve my drawing of adults.
And this was early in his development as a cartoon.
This is in the 20s.
Yeah. In the 20s, yeah.
Yeah, before he did his daily strip.
Right. So it's before Fritzy Ritz and all of that.
Yeah, his goal was to do that kind of work, but he had yet to get the big break that he got. I forget what year that was. It's in my book. Fritzy Ritz was a popular daily comic strip. The guy who did it, a guy named Larry Whittington. In those days, daily strip cartoonists very often worked for and at a daily newspaper.
Mm-hmm.
And the daily newspaper where they worked would syndicate their comics to other newspapers.
Right.
This was before syndicates became just big businesses that took over the whole process. So Larry Whittington had a successful strip and he was seduced by King Features, my syndicate,
mm-hmm.
to leave the New York World syndicate where he was working. And he knew this was in the works and he decided in those days, cartoonists did not own their strips.
Right.
The strip would have been owned by the New York World. So rather than just leave them in the lurch, for a few months before he left, Whittington trained Ernie in taking over the strip. Ernie was 19 years old.
Wow.
He was a copy boy.
Yeah.
This was his dream come true.
What an opportunity.
In his job at the World, he was literally a copy boy. So he would just be carrying stuff back and forth between reporters and the bullpen. The bullpen was the floor where all the artists were, all the illustrators, the cartoonists, anything that had to be, you know, daily as well as editorial cartoonists. So he would go up there a lot, as his job demanded. And he was already soaking up the atmosphere. And, you know, this is what he wanted. He wanted to be a cartoonist. And then all of a sudden it was just given to him, handed to him. He was the youngest daily cartoonist ever.
Wow. Even to this day. Yeah.
Even to this day, the youngest, 19.
Sure, sure. Who's going to be 19 now?
This was way before Nancy. Nancy didn't come along until 1933. This was, when did he start?
Well, early 20s?
Early 20s, 22, I think.
22, okay.
So Nancy, these were characters that he was inheriting. And Fritzy was kind of like she was kind of a flapper, you know, in the 20s style, sort of, independent modern woman. He thought at that point she was already somewhat dated, so he was trying to update her a little. He would give her all kinds of adventures. She actually reminds me a little bit of the Seinfeld show.
Wow.
In the Seinfeld show, every episode, each character usually goes through an entire relationship and it goes from the beginning to the end and they split up at the end of the episode.
Mm-hmm.
And Fritzy, she went through boyfriend after boyfriend after boyfriend with no thought whatsoever about leaving broken hearts in her wake. And this was Ernie's part of his idea. He thought he would, you know, turn her into a more interesting character.
Mm-hmm.
He had her go to Hollywood. He had her, you know, all kinds of storylines. That was not what he really liked. He liked the kind of comics that he loved when he was a kid, which were one, you know, one row gags. Mm-hmm. Where they were self-contained.
Mm-hmm.
Chrissy Ritz was a continuity strip, so you followed her on different adventures.
Yeah.
He was, you know, he had no choice. He had to do that. But
do you know offhand what strips he admired? It's a side question, but it's interesting.
Happy Hooligan was his favorite strip.
Happy Hooligan.
Okay. Happy Hooligan. So that was a classic, early, very early character who, you know, was kind of a homeless bum character, a dimwit. And things, you know, funny things happened to him.
He wore the tin can on his head.
Wore a tin can on his head, yeah. So, I don't know a lot more about what other strips Ernie liked as a kid. But Happy Hooligan is the one he talked about.
Okay.
After 10 years or so of doing Frissy, he thought, this is getting stale. And not only that, he really didn't like the whole idea of this continuing storyline. He had meetings with the editors, and they encouraged him to keep it up because it was a successful strip. And they encouraged him to make it sexy and keep it sexy.
Mm-hmm.
Because it was attracting male eyeballs to the page. And that was something they valued. And, you know, there was no doubt as to what that was all about. Mm-hmm. Frissy, Ernie had to actually keep up with female fashions.
Mm-hmm.
So that when he drew her, she didn't have the same clothes. She always had the latest clothes on. His wife, Abby, helped him with that.
Mm-hmm.
But like I say, he was getting a little bit bored with it. And he was talking to Abby, his wife, about it one day. And she suggested, why don't you bring a kid into the strip? Just find some way to bring a kid and maybe a niece. Because in those days, if you had an adult character and a child was involved with that character, that could not be their blood relative child. It had to be a niece or an uncle, or a niece or a nephew. Because that way there was no sex involved.
Right, right.
So Frissy is sort of annoyed by this niece that pops into one of the strips in 1933. The reaction to the public was, please, more Nancy right away. They were also not, I mean, they weren't as bored as Bushmiller because it was still a popular strip. But once Nancy appeared, his editors and his fans all thought, we want to see more of that. Mm-hmm. The editors actually thought, perfect. Now we get the male gaze of the pretty girl and we get a kid, both major categories of the daily comic strip world. We get both in this one. So
yeah. I always thought it was weird, Nancy, you know, that Nancy's living with her aunt and there's really no explanation ever. It's just Nancy's there and with Fritzy living there. And we have no understanding of where her parents, where are they, what happened to them. Same with Sluggo. No. We don't know what Sluggo's background was either.
I always thought Sluggo was an orphan, but that's just my assumption. There's no evidence of anything. He lived in a house by himself.
Yeah.
Literally, in like a one-room house on Dumb Street, D-U-M-M Street. And he also just appeared one day. And, you know, so Nancy and Frissy, there's an essential strangeness and also strength and oddness
mm-hmm.
to the Nancy strip. Frissy doesn't look like she's coming out of the same comic strip.
No.
As Nancy. Right. So not only are they kind of oddly paired as people, but they're oddly paired as cartoon characters. And Fritzy's job was to remain both sexy and sort of maternal and disciplinarian kind of character for Nancy. So Nancy would do things that would annoy her, and she would, Fritzy would take on the role of the disciplined parent, but at the same time looking sexy while she did it.
Yeah.
Hey, Jeff here, taking a moment to stretch and grab a quick refreshment and to tell you how you can become a contributor to this podcast by joining us at patreon.com/Jeff Grogan. Naturally, production of this podcast is not without its costs, and by joining us at the paid level, you'll ensure that I'll be able to bring you great interviews and discussions with top-notch comics creators on a regular basis. And if you join at the paid level anytime between now and June 1st, you'll receive a free copy of Donut and the Cheeseburger, Race for the White House, mailed directly to your door. So join us, won't you? That's patreon.com/Jeff Grogan.
I remember seeing lots of Fritzy popping in, like you'd see like, you know, a view of her her profile and her shoulders maybe popping in from the edge of a panel, admonishing Nancy for this, that, or the other, and then not seeing much else of her.
Right, unless the, you know, unless Ernie decided to show more. Right. I mean, there's one strip I show in the book where Nancy has tied up Fritzy in what looks like bondage.
Yeah. You know,
sexual bondage. And it's all done just for a joke, for a gag.
Right.
But, you know, Ernie was not unaware of what he was doing in that area. He was going right up to the edge of things you could do and not do in daily comics.
Now, Fritzy continued in her own, like, Sunday topper, didn't she?
Yeah. Fritzy continued. Fritzy didn't die until 1968.
Oh,
Nancy, I mean, under Bushmiller, mm-hmm. Bushmiller died in 1982.
Right.
But yeah.
Do you know anything more about those Fritzy toppers? I mean, did you study those as well as you were, you know, putting this book together?
Sure. Fritzy had a separate life away from Nancy. And in that life, she had a boyfriend called Phil Fumble.
Mm.
And Phil Fumble was in a cartoonish way a stand-in for Ernie himself. Ernie had red hair and it was kind of puffy at the top, and he had what he called, what did he say, his face resembled a melon. He had a melon-shaped face, he said. He, you know, he's being self-deprecating, but Phil Fumble is not a terribly unique character. He's the classic nerdy male who can't get the sexy girl that he's after.
Mm-hmm.
She'll toy with him, but she'll never accept him.
Mm-hmm.
So that dynamic was behind a lot of Fritzy strips that did not include Nancy, and they were mostly on Sunday.
Yeah.
In fact, exclusively on Sunday. You know, strips evolve and change when they last for a long time. For years, when I started doing Zippy, I didn't have the Griffey character.
Right.
And then, you know, after 3 or 4 years without, you know, where Zippy was pretty much on his own. This is another Art Spiegelman anecdote. Remember, I asked Art, I was kind of afraid to hear the answer, but I said, Art, do you like, at that time, Zippy was a weekly strip. I said, what do you think about Zippy? And he said, well, I like the character, but it's a little bit like being stuck in an elevator with a crazy person. you're looking for the, when the door, you know, when your floor will be reached so you can get out. So, you know, he meant that as a sort of a compliment and a criticism. And I remember going home that night and thinking, oh my God, I've got to do something. I don't want to have a character make that kind of response to anybody, much less my friend. So within a few days, I had already created the Griffey character mm-hmm. on his own in weekly strips. And I decided to just go for the idea of the pairing of opposites.
Yeah.
That happens a lot in comedy, like Abbott right. and Costello, you know, the dumb one and the smart one, whatever.
Sure. The straight man.
So, yeah, the straight man. So I thought, well, Griffey would be, you know, who he was. He would be like me. He would be overly analytical and somewhat insecure and self-conscious. And Zippy, of course, would remain true to his nature. He would be open and accepting and spontaneous. And they would bounce off each other. And mm-hmm. they did. And they still do. So.
And Griffey is in Three Rocks as well at the Bushmiller Museum, is he not?
Right. Well, whenever I insert myself into my work, I have the privilege of having created myself as a character. So I summon Griffey for some work in this book. He is a docent in a non-existent fictitious museum of Ernie Bushmiller's art in Stamford, Connecticut, where he lived. A number of people have been tricked into thinking this is a real place. I say it clearly in the book that it's not real.
Yeah.
That doesn't stop some people. The fact that I put it in the Stamford maybe got some of them to think it was real, because that's where, if there was a museum, that's where it would be.
Right. Where Ernie Bushmiller resided.
Right. That's where he.
I almost believed it for half a second there, but I really, what I liked about and do like about that particular, segment of the book, is that in a sense you go into the same kind of discussion of Nancy that you're going through here, detailing for the reader, you know, what it is that makes Nancy more than just a dumb guest.
Yeah. Right. Well, I thought I would just deal with that issue head on and just literally talk about it, not refer to it or toy with it or play with it, but actually just bring it up straight. And so I have Griffey as a character three or four times in the book, giving kind of a lecture to a group of people who are going with him throughout this fictitious Bushmiller Museum. And he's explaining, he's over-explaining why Nancy is so great. And the crowd's reaction is not entirely receptive to that, but that doesn't stop Griffey. I even have a page where I show the strength of Bushmiller's panels is so intense that you can reduce them to the size of a postage stamp or smaller, and they still are decipherable.
I got to tell you, I teach a number of courses here at Adelphi in comics, in illustration, and other things. And I was teaching a class the other day, and I referenced that page. Because I was talking to my students about, you know, production and talking about Nancy. And so I said, here's a great example of, you know, clarity in design and how it works, et cetera, et cetera. And, you know, it really hit them, you know, really worked for them. It's a great page.
Well, I teach comics at the School of Visual Arts in New York. And I assigned my students this past year to each of them to do three Nancy strips.
Oh, wow. Oh,
and they did great stuff.
I'm going to steal that assignment.
I required that they read my book and then do three Nancy strips. So pretend the syndicate that runs Nancy just fired the one that's running now, and they just hired you. And these are your first three strips. And I mean, these kids did amazing stuff. They really got it. I never thought it would work that way. I thought they would, I don't know, they wouldn't get it because they weren't exposed to Nancy before.
Mm-hmm.
When I brought Nancy up in the class, the only one of my students knew Nancy, and I said, how do you know Nancy? And she says, I have a t-shirt with Nancy on it.
Really?
So that was her entire knowledge of Nancy, was just as that iconic Nancy face, that head with the spiky hair, which is out there in all kinds of unlicensed ways, of course.
And there are memes and things. And I thought when I brought Nancy up to the class I was speaking to, that they would know her from memes, but they didn't know her at all.
Which... Well, Nancy is currently being produced by a woman named Olivia James,
mm-hmm.
Who is very odd. She will not make public appearances. She was scheduled to be at the Nancy Fest, and then she pulled out. She said, so the Nancy Fest people asked her to come talk, because there's a lot of controversy around her. You know, should there be this new version of Nancy out there?
Right.
And of course there should. I mean, that's a non-issue, but so she said she would come, but she said she wants to retain her anonymity, so she would wear a hoodie and dark glasses. So when I heard this, I thought, okay, I am going to do my talk with a hoodie and dark glasses. And then she backed out. I had my hoodie and dark glasses already.
So did your students get the gag idea? Did they know, understand the snapper and how to work backwards?
Yeah. Well, they just had read my book. So, of course, that's
okay.
Got to the degree that they got my book.
Yeah.
But the fact that they liked drawing it, too, they did. It shows how, Nancy looks a little bit like the strips. And the characters look a little bit like something you would see in a How to Draw Comics book from, that era. And these kids don't have that background, but they're familiar with the way comics used to look.
Mm-hmm.
They see a lot of animation, and they see a lot of it. They like old animation, some of them. So they're aware of... just the kind of, comics aesthetic from the past. Maybe that helped, but I mean, they did funny and very nice, mimicking of Bushmiller's work. And I thought that was...
Did they get the 69 spikes in the hair? Huh? Did they get the 69 spikes in the hair?
Yeah. Well, in the book, I say there are 65 spikes. I'm being a little bit jokey. There are 65 at a certain size. At a small size, of course, there are less. And at a bigger size, there are either more or less. But 65 was kind of the standard. Just if you look at all of Bushmiller's originals, a lot of which, of course, were done by his assistants in the later years. The characters don't go in and out of close-up and long distance shots. They stay pretty much at the same size. So the guy that the one who did a lot of inking for Bushmiller in the later years, his name was Al Plastino. Great right. name for a cartoonist. He was one of the Superman cartoonists
mm-hmm.
in the 40s. He would get calls from Bushmiller about how the spiky, this there weren't enough spikes in the hair. he said doing Superman was easy compared to doing Nancy, because Bushmiller was a micromanager,
mm-hmm.
and he would call him all the time and tell him, you got something wrong, do it over. which tells you something too. It's
sure. Well, he's a taskmaster.
It's so-called, as simple as the strip is, simplicity is not necessarily easy to replicate. It's got this inner strength that you have to kind of get onto its wavelength to make.
Well, it made me wonder, because you note at the end of the book that you didn't draw any of the pictures of Nancy, right? That you utilized his images. And I was surprised at that. Because obviously, you know, you could do it. It's not an issue there. It's, but I wondered if Bushmiller's ghost was hovering over you while you were doing that.
Well, I thought about it. In my first graphic novel, which was called Invisible Ink,
mm-hmm.
from 2015, that was about a cartoonist to some degree. It was about this guy who had a long secret affair with my mother.
Mm-hmm.
His name was Lawrence Larrier. He was a gag cartoonist, among other things. And when I did that book, I decided I was going to redraw any artwork of Lawrence Larrier's that you saw in the book. It would be accurate, but it would be drawn by me.
Mm-hmm.
I wanted the entire book to feel like it came out of my hand, that there was no jarring element.
Right.
When I thought about what I should do for the Nancy book, I thought there was no way I could possibly as perfectly imitative as I might be able to be, I would never achieve the iconic strength of the Nancy strip,
mm-hmm.
of the characters, of her face. So in that case, I contacted the syndicate who own Nancy to this day, and they gave me, thankfully, they gave me a blanket permission to do.
Oh, wonderful.
To reproduce anything I wanted, to collage in things. What I decided to do, though, was to make any time the character, the Nancy and Sluggo characters, speak in the book, and I use them as transition pages throughout the book, almost as if a new chapter, as a chapter ended and a new chapter began, there would be a page with a black border, and that page would have Nancy speaking,
mm-hmm.
sometimes with Sluggo. And what they would be saying would be a segue from the previous chapter to the next chapter. So they would lead you into the next chapter.
Mm-hmm.
So, of course, that was all my writing.
Right.
And I didn't get that from Bushmiller. I co-opted the characters and gave them, I tried to keep their voice accurate,
mm-hmm.
you know, based on how they sound normally. So, you know, Sluggo is a, you know, kind of a little tough guy voice, and Nancy is a child. I always thought of Nancy, she's supposed to be 8. That's what Bushmiller said, 8 years old.
Right.
I think she was like 8 going on 18. You know, she was 8, but then if she wanted to be something a little more sophisticated, she could be.
Mm-hmm.
Some of it was language, some of it was attitude, some of it was just things she said or did with Sluggo or with Fritzy. But that's another cartoonist's privilege, and it's a thing that happens, an evolution that happens when you do a character. They grow, whether they grow chronologically or whether they grow in mentally, whatever, they don't stay the same. If you're talking about a character with a span of decades.
Well, you know, one of the things that in relation to what you're just saying, but also in relationship to what we're talking about in terms of drawing Nancy, the and with Griffey, the end of the book, the epilogue at the end of the book, it does kind of look like your hands involved there, where Nancy is, you know, in her later years.
Yeah, I decided, okay, when the book ended, when Bushmiller's life, and when you're doing a biography, someone's life has a finite time span, of course. So in 1982, Bushmiller died. And I was at that point in the book when that had happened. And I said, well, I guess that's it. I just have to say here's what happened the day he died. Here's what happened a year after, but that's it. It's over. And I was not happy with that. I couldn't live with that. I thought I've got to do something, a coda, you know, mm-hmm. a tag. I have to put something on this story that says, yes, of course, everybody you know, has to die. And Ernie is no exception. But what can I do to keep the book moving and give it something it doesn't have? And, you know, luckily I come up with this idea. What if there was a rest home, like a retirement center for cartoon care? This is something I did actually in 1980 in an underground comic. I imagined a retirement home for all the underground cartoonists. This is in 1980. So at that point, I meant the first wave, the late 60s to the late 70s, all those mm-hmm. people.
Yeah.
That are all my...
Your peers.
My peers, my fellow cartoonists, all living in San Francisco still. So I did this story where I, as an old man, visit this place, and then I find out all of my peers are there, and I talk to each one of them, and I make it funny, you know, and I find out behind the retirement center is a little creek, and there's a bridge, and on the other side of the bridge are little houses, each of one of which houses the cartoon characters that all of us had. So I posit that the cartoon characters are alive, and they're kept away from their creators by living in these little cottages. Anyway, that's the whole thing I did. So it was 1980. So I decided to revive that idea. So I would, one day I would, as Griffey, I would go on an interview. Mm-hmm. I would want to interview the elderly Nancy. So the only change that I made to Nancy and to Sluggo and to a few of their side characters was that I made them look older by giving them white hair. Mm-hmm. I give a long white beard.
Yes. He's taller too.
Right. Taller. And when that happened, the book really suddenly, to me, it gained this element, this feeling that the rest of the book didn't have. I mean, the rest of the book was still what it was, and I'm trying to be accurate in Bushmiller's life, and I'm trying to make the case for how great he was. But here I am now with the idea that I can walk up to Nancy as she lives and exists today and talk to her, and what would she say to me? And so in the last 24 pages of my book, that's what I do. And Nancy is very reluctant to speak to me at first. Mm-hmm. She's kind of, this is like old stories. She doesn't want to talk about it anymore. Her relationship with Bushmiller was a little bit problematic. He would be too demanding. when I brought up Sluggo, she became very sort of sentimental. That man, I miss him so much. And then I had them have them unite at the end.
Mm-hmm.
So it was a whole book within a book. It was a story within a story that gave the book a dimension it didn't have.
Well, and I have to say, it's, as a reader, I found it so beautiful, really.
Thanks.
I mean, even looking at it now, it's I find it very, as a comics fan, but anybody who's read the book, I think it's just very moving.
Well, that's nice to hear. I was able to give Nancy a voice as if she was a real person, but also to stay true to who she was.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of balancing act I had to do. And to not make myself the most important character in this little separate story. I wanted the idea that Nancy and Sluggo, that they can actually still be alive. to me, and actually what it does is it just reflects what I believe anyway. I mean, I have to say from my childhood, I really do believe, okay, in quotes maybe, that cartoon characters have lives, that they're alive. If a cartoon character has meant something to you,
mm-hmm.
what's the difference between that and someone who's a living person? On some level, no difference. Obviously, there is a difference. I'm not delusional. But I always thought of the cartoon characters that I liked, like, you know, Crazy Cat. Crazy Cat is alive to me.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure that it's true for all comics, but comics that really grab you and pull you in. I mean, you know, a lot of Robert Crumb's characters are alive to me. I don't, you know, part of our brain doesn't distinguish between fiction and reality.
Mm-hmm.
You know? We have sort of a caveman or a cavewoman.
Mm-hmm.
What is it called? The lower part of the brain?
Oh, yeah.
Hippocampus. Yeah. I think it's called the hippocampus. The hippocampus doesn't know. If the hippocampus sees an image of a bird flying across the sky, the hippocampus thinks that's a real bird flying across the real sky. You know it's not true because you have the rest of your brain to tell you that. But at the same time, there is part of you that doesn't distinguish between an image or a fictional creation and the real thing.
Well, and then working on a character for as many years as you've worked on Zippy, I mean, I would imagine that to you, Zippy is a living being in the sense that you go to write, but Zippy in some ways determines his own direction.
When I said, yeah, so this is, yes, it's illustrated every day. When I sit down to do a daily Zippy strip, I'm basically just opening the receptor in my brain that lets Zippy come in and tell me what to do.
Yeah.
And once he enters my little process that way, it's really just my job is to be a bit of an editor, but let him determine sometimes the entire strip, and sometimes when I finish it and I think, wait a minute, I just went too far, no one's going to get this, and then I say, well, that's not my problem, that's right. The reader's problem.
Zippy's not worried about audience response.
Yeah, no, I always said to interviewers early on with Zippy that I'm happy to not, I'm not looking for a peanuts size audience. I'm happy to have a cult following.
Mm-hmm.
And what I do is I put the Zippy strip out there to a certain point, and then I ask the reader to meet me at that point. So meet me halfway. And then we'll be able to, you know,
mm-hmm.
go along the process of reading the strip and getting it. A lot of people don't get that. They don't do that. So they tune off.
Sure.
They tune out.
Well, I'm not one of those people. And I happen to love the strip. But there's a couple of things in regard to, you know, your love of Bushmiller, your love of Nancy, and the book that you've done. And I was kind of knowing your work, but not really being aware of your love of that strip. I was a little surprised that it would be such a, you know, one of your favorite strips, because on the surface, the work that you do in Zippy is somewhat in opposition to what Bushmiller does.
I know. While I was doing the book in the early stages, and I was able to talk to Ernie's friend and get input as to his tastes and things. His name was Jim. I said, Jim, do you think Ernie would What do you think of Zippy? And he said it would be a head scratcher for him.
Did you know I may be a podcast host by day, but by night I don cape and cowl and with iPad pencil in hand draw my butt off on all kinds of comics projects and art. And you can check out my work, my handiwork, and even buy it at Etsy.com/shop/comicsprintworks. That's Etsy.com/shop/comicsprintworks. Okay, I don't really wear cape and cowl while I'm drawing, but you get the idea. That's Etsy.com/shop/comicsprintworks. And now, back to the show.
I said, did Ernie know anything about Underground Comics? And he said, yes, I brought him Zap number one.
Wow.
I handed it to him and he looked at it and he flipped through it. And then he said, good, and gave it back to me. He didn't want to talk about it. Over the years, since then, Jim realized what it is. Bushmiller respected Robert's artwork, but the subject matter was a little too squeamish for him.
Mm-hmm.
So Zippy and Ernie would not have been a good match, I don't think.
Well, Zippy is...
Zippy exists in some ways in a surreal... You know, yeah. Zippy is a surreal character in the real world. That's how it operates. A surreal character in a surreal world is a short circuit. That doesn't... Right. I mean, people do it, but I don't think it goes anywhere. But a surreal character in a real world in which the real world is actually unbendable. It's real. That makes the surreal character have to operate in it. And there, that's where stories come from. That's where humor comes from. Satire, just wordplay, all kinds of things come out of that. So in that sense, there is a little bit of a similarity, but it wasn't, you know, the surreal nature of Nancy. When Ernie was, I asked him, his friend, also I said, was Ernie aware of the people who thought of him the way I do? That he was a very sophisticated guy doing an underappreciated strip. And Jim said, yes. He appreciated and liked that he had somewhat of a hip audience towards the end of his life,
mm-hmm.
but he didn't really want to get into it. He didn't want to encourage it or acknowledge it. He liked it. I remember the first episode of Saturday Night Live, 1976. Was it sitting at 76 or 5?
I think it was 76. Yeah.
Anyway, the first episode. At the end of it, they flashed a bunch of images of people on the screen and said how these were, I forget the words that were being used. It was just a way of saying, we're hip and these people aren't. And John Wayne was one of them. This is images went on. It was at the end of the show. It was, what's his name, Michael... The writer.
I know who you're talking about. I can see
the main writers for SNL.
Yeah, Mike. I can't remember. Who.
National Lampoon guy.
Anyway, yep, I know who it was.
He did. And one of the images that flashed on the screen was Nancy. And it was together with like Lawrence Welk and
yeah. John.
And we're much hipper than these people. And that was Ernie saw that. People, I mean, he didn't see it, but people told him about it.
Okay.
So that and other things made him aware that there was this fan base for his strip that was not the one that was just there for the gag or because they thought Nancy was cute.
Mm-hmm.
And his response was not to turn it away. He liked it, but he didn't want to get involved with it.
Sure.
Yeah. He thought of it as mostly college students. That's how he thought of them, mostly college students. That was his way of describing them.
Acknowledging it might have also put him in a position of sort of engaging with some of the thoughts about Nancy, you know, the intellectualization of Nancy, and that he may have seen that as an impediment to coming up with gags.
Right. It was a road he did not want to go down. Yeah.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah, because his process was very, in a lot of ways, it was very, you know, formulaic, very straightforward. It's based on the snapper, the idea of the joke, and it all works from there, which led him into surreal territory, which is different from how you get into surreal territory.
Well, don't forget, Ernie worked backwards. And
yes.
When I first read this and heard about it, I thought it was, you know, it couldn't really be true, or maybe it was true once in a while, but apparently it was always true. So Ernie would think of an image that he thought was funny, a juxtaposition of one thing with another, usually. Mm-hmm. So, okay, he thought, well, that's my snapper, but it's not funny because you have to build to the snapper. The snapper is the end product. It's not on its own. On its own, it's nothing. Or it's interesting, but it's not funny. So then he would go backwards, whatever it took, 2 panels, 3 panels, 4 panels, to go backward and create the sequence that would lead to that mm-hmm. sight gag that he thought of. And he did it over and over again. He was famous for using the Sears Roebuck catalog to get an idea for an image. So he would flip the pages randomly and point to something. You know, it's a toilet plunger. Okay, I can make a joke out of a toilet plunger.
Right.
And it's going to be on Sluggo's head, something. Then that's great. That's a funny image. How do I build to it? And that's how he did his strips. He was the only cartoonist who did that. There's only two moments when he gave interviews that are recorded. One was from the late 40s, and he was on a radio program in which he and Milton Caniff were being interviewed together. Milton Caniff of Steve
Terry
Canyon,
and
Terry and the Pirates, yeah. And Milton Caniff, when you listen to this interview, Milton Caniff is somewhat of a blowhard. He's dominating the interview. And then the interviewer just kind of interrupts him and says, "So Ernie, I understand you work backwards. That must be a really interesting way of doing a comic strip." And then Ernie says, "Well, I know somebody who works upside down, so I'm nothing." He said, "You should talk to this guy." And of course, it was just a joke.
Oh, it's great.
Ernie was not interested in fame, or, you know, Ernie at towards the end of his life was making $15,000 a week.
Oh. You know?
I mean, this was not unusual. If you're in 900 newspapers, do the math.
Yeah.
You know, $10, $20 per paper. That's you know, or more sometimes.
Yeah.
So what was he doing? He had no hobbies. He had no vices. When he died, he had a huge estate, most of which he left to charities.
Oh, he did? Wow, how interesting.
He
because he didn't have kids.
Yeah, he established a scholarship. I forget the college. But he gave a huge amount of it to SPCA. I don't know. I can't remember. I asked his friend, who was his kind of his accountant, among other things. I said, "Can I look at his will?" And that was one thing I was not able to do. I couldn't see the will. But he did tell me that it was almost all left to charity because he was so wealthy. In those days, I remember reading sometime in the 70s or 80s, after Elvis Presley had already died, the top five earners in the United States, two of the top five earners were the Elvis estate and Charles Schulz.
Right. Yeah, Charles Schulz was huge.
In the entire country. Like, the Elon Musks of their time, in effect, that category of
wow. I never think of Charles Schulz that way.
He made $25 million a year just from merchandising.
Incredible! Incredible. Wow.
Very humble guy, you know.
Sure. Did you ever? I mean, speaking of either of those cartoons, did you ever meet Charles Schulz or Ernie Bushmiller?
I never met Ernie, but I met Charles Schulz a few times. When I lived in San Francisco, he, you know, his home was in Santa Rosa, which is about 45 minutes north of San Francisco. And, he, you know, his daughter was an Olympic skater. And so as a gift to her, he built a skating rink in Santa Rosa, a real full-fledged skating rink, ice skating rink.
Mm-hmm.
And for a number of years, Schulz would invite Bay Area cartoonists to come there for their Christmas special, where they would do a whole extravaganza on the ice that his daughter choreographed. So I went on two different occasions with a bunch of other of us underground cartoonists. He made it clear that he thought he liked the underground work. Once again, he only talked about the artwork and never about the content.
Mm-hmm.
He wanted to know what kind of pen I used, you know, all that kind of stuff. I remember at one point he said to me, when I go, I want to make room for another cartoonist on the comics page.
Mm-hmm.
And I just took that in as a nice gesture and an indication of his humility. And I just thought of it as true. Of course, then when he died, that never happened because the syndicate convinced his wife very, very, I can't hold it against her. If we cancel the Peanut strip, the merchandising will be severely affected. The Christmas animation specials, all of that will slowly go away because it'll look like Peanuts is over.
Mm-hmm.
If we run reprints, that will not be thought of as that way.
Mm.
So she said, okay, so that's it. To this day, they're running reprints. And,
well, it's a double-edged sword, actually, you know, when you think about it.
Yeah.
My students know who Charlie Brown and Peanuts are, but they don't know who Calvin and Hobbes are.
Yeah, right.
You know, but yeah. I'm thinking about that. But, you know, getting back just very briefly to the book and talking about his process, Bushmiller's process, you do a wonderful opening where he's thinking about a meat grinder. Abby has asked him to pick up a meat grinder.
Yeah.
And you walk us through his process really quite nicely. And one of the great things about it is that when he gets home, he's got a comic strip in his mind, but he doesn't have the meat grinder she asked him to pick up, which, you know, I think is indicative of a lot of artists who are living in their heads, you know?
Yes, that's absolutely true. And unless you, I mean, the other aspect of that is unless you do something with that idea quickly, you will lose it also.
Mm-hmm.
Inspirations like that are ephemeral. They come from who knows where. A lot of cartoonists I know say they get a lot of ideas while driving. So somehow getting into that mindset when you're driving, that opens up a part of your brain that, you know. So I have, you know, and I'm very careful about it. I have a notepad right there on the dashboard, ready to write. And because I get ideas all the time.
While you're
just driving, you know, a 10-minute drive somewhere, I have to be kind of ready to write down an idea. There's also that moment before you fully wake up where you're still somewhat in your subconscious. And that also is a place where, you know, you need to have a little notepad. And because those ideas go away quickly.
Do you tell your students to do that, to have notepads nearby?
I do. Well, I tell them to keep a little notebook. Of course, they just think, well, why should I do that? My phone, I can say it on my phone.
Yeah, of course.
I said, well, yeah, but maybe that would, I mean, maybe you wouldn't say it on your phone because you're in a public place and you'll be weird, looked at weirdly. Anyway, I even tell them where to buy the notebooks that I use. Very tiny Japanese notebooks that I buy.
There's something about writing, you know.
And there's something about writing also. Writing has been proven to have weight, you know, to have words of weight that speech doesn't.
Well, speaking, and this kind of leads me into other territory, but I was thinking of Zippy, and there are multiple things that I wanted to mention here, both in relationship to Bushmiller or not, but in regard to what you're just saying there, I'm wondering about, like, the ideas that come to you for Zippy. They can't possibly be traditional gag ideas. They do you have just simply non sequiturs that come to you, or are there observations?
Well, I try to tune into the zippy part of my own brain, you know, and that part of my brain is non-linear. It is non-critical. It likes to play with language, and it's alive. And it's real enough so that I can tap into it. And, yes, it's not the traditional place where gags come from. On the other hand, I can start out a strip idea that's very Griffey oriented, where, let's say I'm thinking, all the people that are getting tattoos today, young people getting tattoos, project that into their 50s. How many of them are going to regret those tattoos? And are they going to go to get tattoo removal? So that's a Griffey thought. That's a social, little bit of social criticism, and also a little bit of snottiness and whatever. So then what would Zippy respond to the idea of Griffey talking about tattoos? So then there you go. There's a strip.
One of the things I love about Zippy, the interplay between Griffey and Zippy is wonderful. One of the things I love about Zippy, though, is there is a rhythmic quality. I love language, and I love, writing with attention to the rhythm and the music of language. And you seem to be very attuned to that. And that's something I don't think a lot of comic strip artists or comic strips, daily comic strips are engaged in. But for me, when I read Zippy, the humor in it comes out of the sound of words and the way the words relate musically.
It's really nice to hear, because that's just what I'm doing. In the late 90s, there was always some Hollywood feeler going on about Zippy from the early 80s to the late 90s. Nothing ever really happened, but I never turned down a Hollywood meeting, because they were always full of material for me. And there was always money too. It's a certain amount of money. So this was the idea of doing an animated half hour show. And it was with the people who had done, or were still even doing, this animated show called The Tick. I don't know if you're familiar.
Sure, of
with
course,
it.
I recall.
Okay. So this was, this was real. And so they asked me if it was okay if we had, if they would find some writers to work with me. And I was a little bit reluctant, but I said, yeah, let's try. And if I don't like them, I won't use them. So they hooked me up with two Seinfeld writers. And one of them, well, they were both wonderful. And one of them was really into the idea of how humor and pacing and rhythm are deeply connected. He said, how many times have you watched Kramer on the Seinfeld show get a laugh? But if you then read that on a piece of paper, there's no joke.
Right.
It's his body language, his eye movement, his facial expression, the pacing of the literally of the words as they come out of his mouth. That's what makes it funny. And he said, when doing anything, like that, an animation half hour TV show that was animated was still in the same ballpark as a Seinfeld sitcom. He said, we have to be really conscious of that. And he also said, that was my job, he said, on Seinfeld. I didn't really write storylines. I was the script doctor, and I was also the architect. So if every Seinfeld episode, all four characters had to go through their own thread, and those threads then had to connect at the end and all pay off. So his job and Larry David's job, that was Larry David really was at the core of that, was to make all that mesh, make it work. And some of it was done with just a few words, you know, just the way they.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah. So I learned a lot, but I'd already done, I thought, with this guy, Bruce, his name was Bruce Kirschbaum. And I thought I liked what he was saying because I thought, well, that's what I do.
Yeah.
I do that all the time. When I write a zippy strip, I don't speak it out loud as I'm doing it, but I hold it at a distance from me, just so it's not right in front of me. I hold it a little bit away. And I imagine if it was out loud, were the syllables in the right place? Were the stresses on those syllables in the right place? And that just came to me. It just, that was like, I was tuned into that way of analyzing and dissecting what I was doing, because I knew that with one too many syllables, something is no longer funny, or as even readable, that even scans, you know, there's a, I guess scanning is probably a good way to describe it. If a sentence doesn't scan, doesn't flow, as the writer of that sentence, you should know that that's not flowing, and yes, there should be a way to fix it or abandon it. And Zippy uses language a little bit like as if it was a musical instrument. Yeah, so he's playing the instrument of the words of his non sequiturs. He's, to him, the at least half the pleasure of making those non sequiturs is the way they sound.
Yeah,
it's the way they flow out of your mouth.
Yeah. And exactly, and I love, like, I think one that if you don't read them like if you're just scanning the newspaper and you read Zippy like the way you might read, I don't know, one of the strips that goes by really quickly, you're going to miss the joy of reading the strip, because the joy of the strip for me not only is through the artwork and the interplay of the characters in that pictorial space, but it's also just in the musicality of the language, of the words, and how absurd they are, but how wonderful they flow off of your tongue as you speak them. And so if you read it quickly, you miss out on that.
That was the hardest and still is the hardest thing for me to convey to students.
Mm-hmm.
I think it might have to be innate. I don't know. I'm not sure.
Well, it is one of the things I know when I'm doing my own work, I'm crafting something that's being said. I play with the syllables over and over again, and and oftentimes write a line, go back, read it again, write it again, write it again, write it again, until it's just the way the letters, you know, the syllables flow into one another that makes it funny or not funny, and it falls flat if it's not, if the rhythm's not.
Yeah, well, I'm glad to hear that we're on the same page with that, because that's not something that most people, most of my fans don't go into that kind of detail with me. By the way, I am going to have to cut this short.
Oh, okay. Geez, I know we've been on for a while, and I really appreciate your time. I would love to be able to talk to you again sometime, because I've read all of your novels and your graphic novels, and I'd love to talk to you about them, because Invisible Ink and Nobody's Fool are both beautiful books. They're filled with beautiful moments and moving moments, and I'd love to talk to you about both of them in the future. If you have some time, maybe we can connect again another time.
Absolutely. Yeah, just, you have my email, so let's think about that as sometime in the future. Yeah, sure.
Okay, maybe perhaps over the summer or something.
Absolutely.
Okay. Yep. Well, Bill, so thank you so much for today. I really appreciate it. It's been a joy. And a lot of ways, you know, it's been an honor, because I'm such a big fan, and I love your work, and it's just been great. And I'm so
thanks.
that you came out today.
I've enjoyed it too. Thanks a lot.
So there you have it. Bill Griffith, Nancy, Ernie Bushmiller, and Zippy as well on top of that. I'm hoping that this is the first of several conversations. Bill's career certainly has so much material to draw from and to talk about. There's so many things that I'd love to ask him about, whether it's the early years of the underground comics movement or whether it's Zippy or just about his graphic biographies. I'd love to talk to him about Invisible Ink, which I think is probably my favorite of, maybe, I don't know, it's hard to choose a favorite, but it certainly moved me because I think anybody who's reading it relates to that story. I related to it because, you know, I lost my mother a number of years ago, and I find myself as I'm getting older, I'm older than now than she was when she passed away. I find that I wonder about her life and her point of view and what her hopes and dreams were, those kinds of things. And but on the other hand, maybe I don't want to know, you know, I don't know. Anyway, I think all of us have those questions, and I think Invisible Ink is one of those books that takes us into that territory. But it's also, you know, just in terms of a life story, it's a fascinating story, and I really enjoyed it. I enjoyed Bill taking us along for that ride, as I did in all the books. As I said, they all have a great sense of the era, of the time and the place. And a lot of that comes through Bill's rendering, which is exquisite pen and ink work, just gorgeous. There are some cityscapes, there's some landscapes that are just beautiful, and all, you know, traditional pen and ink work, and really great. I just love it. And they're wonderful books. Wonderful as works of art, really, as well as stories. So that leaves us with what's happening next. And what's happening next, I'm going to leave open for the time being. To be honest with you, I've been sick for a couple of weeks now. I've been under the weather and struggling to get better. And so you could probably hear it in my voice, both in the interview and now. So I haven't got anything planned immediately. I hope to. I've got some ideas, and we shall see. And I hope to get to that sooner rather than later. I don't want to let any great length of time go by for the next episode. Of course, by this time, I've already probably done my interview with Andy Smith, which is happening on Wednesday the 15th. So I'm not sure if you would have heard me there or not, but I'm recording this beforehand, so I don't know how that's going to go, but I'm looking forward to it. After that, I finish my semester, and the summer beckons. And so I'll have some great time on my hands. I will have a new Kickstarter for Dacre Jones, number two, Captain Dacre Jones, and the Space Rockettes number two, the Sunday Adventures, which is a tabloid newspaper, full color, each page like a page from a Sunday comic strip. It's as though you're collecting all of, you know, an adventure strip in one newspaper. And I'm excited about it because I enjoyed working in this format for my last Kickstarter, Donut and the Cheeseburger. Turned out real well, and I'm really looking forward to this. And this is going to, let's see, that Kickstarter is going to launch on June 18th. Okay, June 18th. So be looking for that. I will be back beforehand to remind you, but I hope you'll join in and participate because it's going to be a lot of fun. And I'm hoping to print enough copies of that to bring it with me to Crossroads Columbus, where I'll be in September of this year. I'm really looking forward to going to Columbus to seeing the Nancy Show and to participating in this great event, Crossroads Columbus, which has become one of the premier indie comics art festivals. Well, that should do it for now. I hope you guys are all well and healthy and happy and taking care of one another. And I'll be back soon. So until then, take care, folks. And as always, thanks for listening.